Hello, and welcome to episode 117 of the Planning Period Podcast, part of the On Podcast Media Network. I'm your host, Brad Treffler. This week on the show, I'm joined by Dan Roeder. Dan is an education specialist, performer, composer, and collaborator. He reached out to me to ask us some questions about starting his own podcast, and after chatting a little bit, I decided to invite him on my show. Dan and I talk about self-contained, giving way to pull in from outside, taking UDL to a bigger scope, the disconnects when we don't communicate the why of our actions in and out of the classroom, honoring student devices, addressing students and behaviors, not devices, and how great teachers make you want to be better than you are. So, sit back and enjoy episode 117 of the Planning Period Podcast, my interview with Dan Roeder. Hello, everybody, and today we got to do a little bit of almost a podcasting blind date. I got messaged by this guy to say, hey, I'm thinking about starting my own podcast, listen to yours, and was looking for any kind of advice. And so we had a little chat back and forth and about podcasting equipment and hardware and stuff. And I was like, yeah, this is a pretty cool chat. Why don't you come join me on the show and we'll just do my usual thing and chat about education and see where your head's at. And he said, sure. So today I am joined by Dan Roeder. How you doing?
Doing excellent.
Doing really good. Well. Good. I'm glad to have you here, man. You know, we did have a nice little chat about podcasting and talking about some cool stuff there, which if anyone ever wants to excite me, the question is like, hey, I want to start a podcast. Do you have any ideas?
Yeah.
No, I have a lot of ideas and they will fit onto a DM, but you are going to have to scroll for a while.
I concur. And that was amazing. I think my response was, thank you for the thorough and thoughtful response.
It is something I do love to talk about. I've talked about it a number of times at conferences and especially ed camps. I tend to talk about it wherever I'm at an ed camp. And, you know, it's one of those things I love to talk about. So you hit me right on that passion
there.
So Dan, you are a special education teacher. You've got a background in music. You're telling me a little bit about it before we start recording. So for my audience, can you just give an idea of who you are and your space?
Yeah. So I am out in rural California and I'm a third year intern teacher in special education. I'm going through my credentialing program right now. So it's one of those situations where I just get to really do trial by fire. And today happened to be one of those days where it's just like kind of juggling flaming chainsaws. And then you get to the end of the day and it's like, hey, that's a day in special ed. So that's kind of my day job. I'm still composing music, which was my first career and my passion. Ever since high school, I had a really great high school music teacher in Minnesota, and that was Robert Sieving, just a really inspirational guy, and got me loving music. And then I got into formally studying music through music theory, of all places, and then I learned how to sing and play instruments in college. So that led me to a path in creating film scores and just being in general a collaborator. I consider myself somebody that can work with anybody. I always like to see all the pieces of the puzzle and then just play with them. I tend not to really be a start with the corners type of person. I just jump into the middle. That took me through collaborating with choreographers and writing dance music. I actually ended up touring with an artist as her keyboard player and a vocalist, Taichi. She was a Croatian pop star in the 90s. I'm working right now with an artist, Polly Z, down in LA on some music educational projects. And so I think I was telling you earlier, I consider myself a bump and go person. Like, something looks cool, something looks shiny, something looks really useful for students, I'm gonna gravitate, I'm gonna learn about it, and I'm gonna find a way to use it.
So you said your third year of internship.
Yes.
That's a lot of internship.
It is. And you know, the funny thing about coming from music is that I had never taken an ed class in college. I have a master's in composition from Iowa. And then coming here to California, I thought surely something will transfer where, you know, they can just count it as an ed class or something like that, or public speaking. I don't know. But I had to take a 1 year full load of courses of just like the basic intro ed courses and intro to special ed. my first year of my internship. So I was teaching full-time and a full-time student, and learning how to do a whole special ed program while I'm learning assessment, you know. So sure. it was definitely fun.
It's a lot all at once. That is a lot.
Yeah.
So I can definitely, you know, it kind of almost feels like you know, we do alternative certification here where, you know, anyone with a bachelor's degree can basically become a teacher. And you have to take courses in your first 3 years. But what it effectively creates is the same thing. But you're in classrooms all day every day without the experience.
Right.
So it's like you're in classrooms all day every day, no clue what you're doing, and then taking classes at night to learn what you did wrong during that day
and then trying to fix it the next day. Sleeping and so, like family, yeah. I'll check with you later.
Yep.
It's kind of similar in Minnesota. I taught for a year on a variance. I've never heard of a variance anywhere other than Minnesota. That just meant the district said, we can't find a teacher. So you have a bachelor's, here, have a 3-day program on how to manage a classroom. And then, here you go, have a year contract. And it was really cool.
Yeah. That seems effective. I'm about three days is all you really need. I don't know why.
Why
do people go to college? Just 3 days.
Way too much, actually. Yeah. I was bored.
<Just kidding. laughs> I joke regularly that to become a substitute in Florida, the only things they teach you in the 8-hour training is don't wear jeans and don't touch kids. And I say that sort of like facetiously, except that everyone in that room had a lot of questions about those two very simple rules.
Wow.
Like, well, but what if it's a Friday? Yeah, don't wear jeans.
Don't wear jeans.
But what if all my other clothes are dirty?
Yeah.
Don't wear jeans.
Wash your clothes.
What if I've been to the school before and I've seen that the teachers wear jeans? Don't wear jeans. Oh, okay. And then it's like, well, what if I want to give a kid a high five? Don't touch a kid. What about a handshake? Don't touch kids. What about a hug? Now we're going the wrong direction. Yeah. I don't even know.
Yeah.
And it was still like, there were hours of questions about those two things.
And I was just thinking while you were talking about that, I'm like, did they tell them what they should do? Where's the action verb? What are we supposed to be doing? Where's the model?
Yeah, apparently. Their instructional strategies were about as strong as I expect a substitute to have. So.
Yep. There you go.
So, that's interesting. So you're in special ed as an intern. I mean, that means you have a full-time teacher with you while you're there, or?
Yeah, I have a really amazing relationship with the collaborating teacher that I have. I worked with her out at a court school, actually. Mm-hmm. She is the one who convinced me to get into teaching in the first place and said, hey, I know you when you're not on tour, you're looking for work and maybe you can, just get hired on as a sub. And so she kind of opened the door that way. And then between her and her boss at the time, they convinced me that I should just teach more and more days and then start teaching at this court school and then take a summer contract at the court school and then become a teacher. I actually, really long, convoluted story, somewhat short. We're now teaching in the same classroom, and she's my collaborating teacher for the program. And handle more of the mod to severe level of interventions, and then she does more mild, moderate interventions. But we really both we both pride ourselves in building bridges both ways into special education. You know, there's, we believe wholeheartedly in inclusion, but I think there's also an element of bringing others in. So you don't just push in one direction. So example of that, we're co-coaching the academic decathlon team, which the district hasn't really had too much involvement in the last decade or so, and we actually took first place in it, and it was amazing. And our classroom has just become kind of a cool, chill place to hang out during lunch. And we're really with the MTSS model, we're focused on that second tier as well, and bringing in as many students fluidly as we can to say, hey, you need instruction in this moment? Okay, here's what we can do. Here's some different modalities we can look at. Here's some different ways we can understand this. Now go teach your classmates, you know? So that's kind of the benefits of pulling in. So I think that's honestly what full inclusion looks like. It looks like UDL. It looks like really reaching every learner full force, giving complete access to everybody for every project in a meaningful way. And that's okay. I think I'm getting on a soapbox, so maybe I'll step down.
No, I like it. I'm about it. I'm about
that's
it.
Passion.
You know, my next question was gonna be sort of what drew you into special ed, but I think you sort of hit a lot of it right there. I was gonna say, I think that passion comes across pretty clearly about what that should look like, and I think the vision is the right idea. So just to clarify, when you say pulling in, you guys are bringing in students that are not in your sort of ESE self-contained space and inviting them into that space. Absolutely. Is that what that looks like?
Actually, we inherited a self-contained space, but we don't believe in a self-contained space. So we're trying to actually bury that stigma in like countywide. And just because we don't kind of when we came on board, some of the teachers were saying, oh, you know, they can help you with that over in special ed. And we would just in the moment say, oh, no, room one, room three. They're just rooms. They're classrooms. And we don't really need to we don't call your room, you know, that's the science room. That's room eight. That's, you know, Mrs. Whoever's room. That's part of it. But another part of it is not being too, I don't know the right word, but not being too selfish with who we're serving and not saying, you know, this student has an IEP, so I need to spend this amount of time with this person. You know, obviously, you know, federal law, we have to track that. We have to meet those, but there's nothing wrong with over delivering. I think it's really important when you're meeting other people's specified needs and specified modifications, accommodations, that you're trying to make as many peer relationships activate as possible, so that you can, it just becomes another room at the school. It just becomes a place. It just becomes a method of learning. Like, I don't understand this. I'm not getting what the teacher's saying. Oh, well, I can ask somebody else. It's not even saying asking myself or my co-teacher. It's saying I can just ask somebody else. I can find somebody who understands it in a different way and maybe can teach me that way to help me understand. That's kind of the skills that we're really trying to foster.
I really like that idea that you're you know, like you said, sort of not being selfish with those services and that support, you know, giving the support to those that need it. And it is that sort of UDL feel of, if this is working for these students, it's probably going to work for other ones as well. And so why shouldn't we provide those services if they're going to help students and help them learn? Right. If that's our ultimate goal, like it doesn't.
Yeah. Well, I would much rather spend my energy being a facilitator of understanding than a gatekeeper of services and of resources. I just this afternoon I had a conversation with a student. They were just kind of frustrated that, so-and-so had a special plan that gave them this. Why can't I have that? And then I just said, why can't you? And she was like, well, because nobody said I could. Did anyone tell you can't? No. I think it's teaching everybody self-advocacy and teaching everybody to get what they need. At the same time, we're really in a wave of education right now where we're trying to deliver what everyone needs. I think we have to remember to teach our students and to remind our students to tell us what they need and to find different ways for them to do that. And I love what I'm seeing in ed tech, you know, with all of the ways to reach everyone, like Flipgrid and different ways to flip your classroom, ways to make sure that there's no stone left unturned when it comes to assessment, and just infusing classes with really low stakes informal assessment instead of, you know, teaching to the test. And that's kind of where I see myself going as far as educational philosophy. Like, I don't even remember what the question is anymore that we're talking about, but
we're just rambling. I don't even know what the question was. Yeah. It's fine.
But I see myself as someone who just wants to hack the feedback loop of you do your homework, you wait like a day, maybe I got busy, so it's 2 days, and maybe my feedback wasn't that great, and maybe I graded your paper at 11 o'clock, so I was just kind of an autopilot. And, you know, so what I think education needs to be, and it is becoming, is a lot more feedback in the moment, so we know what's going on before that student leaves our classroom, and we know what they're going to struggle with. Homework for me is a whole can of worms. So like, I don't know if we want to go there or not, but I just think there's that, if we spend our time and our energy creating really full and enriching educational experiences within class, we may not need as much homework.
So it's a very, very calm and centrist way to say that.
I like yeah,
that.
Right, right.
So no, it's good. I'm with you. I think that, you know, that you're right. It's there's things that are, you know, that there is a wave of change that is we're sort of riding right now, and I think it's good. I think a lot of the change is very good, even though sometimes it can feel like that change isn't happening fast enough. But yeah, I'm in. All right, let's you know, we're already rolling and rocking, and for some reason doing it backwards, and I think we'll go into my first question. And you may have already touched on it because you kind of hit on a bunch of stuff already, but my first question, of course, for all my guests is, what is the biggest problem facing education today?
I think for me it's communication, and that's a big umbrella term, but more specifically it's disconnects in ways that we can collaborate as staffs, and ways that we can collaborate with our students, with our families. And I think there's so many possibilities for breakdowns in communication, because we're considering so many more modalities now, where we have either calls or texts or emails or face-to-face or whatever, you know. So for me, I think sometimes where I always go to, my mind goes to with communication breakdown is staff meetings. I think we're just really still in love with the idea of staff meetings, of face-to-face, everybody come to the same room in the same place at the same time. We're going to roll out some new thoughts, and we're going to roll out what we're all going to want to do as a united front. And I think there's a lot of good rallying energy to that. And I think that in an appropriate context, that's really effective. But I think if we take a step back on communication, what's the purpose of the meeting? And why are we all in the same room at the same time together? And if we don't have a good answer for that, like if the answer is just because we have a staff meeting, then I think maybe there's alternatives. That's the benefit of having such a rich number of choices to communicate with staff. Because I you know, even 3 years into a full-time teaching job, I've been to meetings that are just phenomenal and that are so well run and driven, and like, oh my gosh, my life has changed after this meeting because I learned so much. And trainings are like that too. And then I've been to both meetings and trainings where that why hasn't really been distilled and crystallized. And then it's just, well, because. And I think can be the same in a classroom. You have a group of like 15 to 42 students, you know, however your big your district is. If you can't answer the question, why are we all together in the same space at the same time? If the answer is because we have class, then there's a problem. There's a disconnect. And what's the purpose? What's the goal? What's the objective? And I think I myself have gone into autopilot sometimes. I think it's the nature of being a teacher and navigating those ebbs and flows of schedules. But I sometimes have failed to communicate like why we're doing this particular thing and what we're going to get out of it. And then I find 10 minutes into the lesson, I don't even remember why I'm teaching it myself. And then I get the question, when do I have to know this? Like, it's making your brain grow. Just trust me. And like, you know, then it's not great. But I think it's that communication, as long as we can identify why we're communicating with somebody, whether it's to a class or to a staff or to a school board meeting or whatever, just showing up is not enough. Showing up with purpose every time is a big call and it's hard to do. But I think even if we just acknowledge that that's important, to have that purpose and to have that objective, then I think it just alleviates a lot of problems.
Interesting. Yeah. It's weird to me because I hear this idea of bad staff meetings still coming up sometimes, and we don't do staff meetings at my school ever, you know? Yeah. So it's sometimes I have to remind myself that that's not the case everywhere else, right? Like there are plenty of schools where they are still a weekly or every other week meeting that everyone has to attend for no particular purpose. And whenever you have to start the meeting with, all right, we're going to make this quick, like you don't really, you probably don't need to be there then.
Yeah.
If you're going to make this quick, you probably didn't need to begin with.
All right, this could be an email, but, or, you know, that's the other thing. It's like, when is it an email and when is it something like Slack or Google Classroom or something like that, that has, or Voxer, like I love Voxer. I'm a Voxer nut. Something like that has more channel oriented. I think it's defining, what do I have to say? Who do I have to say it to? How am I going to say it? And what is going to be the result?
Well, and I think the problem we ask is when we are, for a lot of leaders, when they're choosing the communication style, they're choosing it based on how important it is, right?
Right.
And compliance is a lot easier when everyone's sitting in front of you. So if something's really important, then I'm going to make it a staff meeting. But you wouldn't do that in your classroom necessarily, right? Like you would hopefully in your classroom, you would pick the mode of instruction that is most effective for the learning, right?
Right.
Like I wouldn't say that, you know, motion of the planets is really important. And so I'm just going to make sure I say it a lot and explain it really thoroughly to them in my own words without giving them any visuals or videos.
Right.
Because that's really, really critical and I need them to understand it. Like, no, that doesn't make sense. I'm not going to do that. They need to see it. It needs to be right. Like, so I think we play with compliance, and it's something I've been thinking about a lot of, like, again, that classroom style and taking some of those flipped methods. And if something is really important, send it out as an email, because those people who were going to sit in your meeting annoyed that you're wasting their time are going to do it in the email. They're going to read it. And then just have a compliance piece, have something of just a quick, did you do it? You know, all the tools that we use for a flipped classroom, whether it's Edpuzzle or, you know, the a lot of LMSs have built in tracking of watching videos and things like that. You know, if you're do something to quickly monitor who didn't do it, and now send a follow-up urgent, you 20 did. People that yep. didn't do it, you get to come to a meeting with me. And
yeah.
Okay. I guarantee you they do it off the email the second time though.
Yeah. No, I get that. But you brought up the compliance piece, and I think that does kind of bleed into the classroom sometimes too. And that's also a communication breakdown in my eyes. When you're just having somebody do something for the sake of compliance, then you've already lost the student. You're actually creating tiny traumas that rather than creating tiny learning moments. and I think all of us as teachers want to create the learning moments. Otherwise, we probably wouldn't be teachers, like we're good, I would think. I don't know that we're, you know, I don't know that we're all cognizant of the effects of having somebody do something just for the sake of compliance, and how many times many of those students have had that happen in their lives. And maybe, you know, there's something we don't know about. Maybe it's a student with a high A score that has already had a lot of trauma, and it's because somebody is just very demanding in their life. And then every time somebody's just demanding that they turn their homework in on time, it's one more little trauma that is added to that, instead of trying to undo that and to heal that and allow them processing Just, you know, it could be as easy as a question. Do you need more time? You know, or do you get it? Do you understand it? How can I help? And there, I think I see that a lot more than I'd like to, especially since I get to be a special educator and I get to buzz around to other classrooms a lot and see different teaching styles and different modalities. That's probably the thing I see a lot is penalizing late work and not really following that up with something that is rebuilding relationship. And that's, I think it's critical. Like if somebody's going to continually be penalized, then there has to be some sort of relational capacity that's rebuilt.
Well, and I think to sort of connect those is that we try to use with students, we try to use grades as a communication tool,
right?
And especially as a communication tool to parents. And the problem is it's an ineffective method to communicate the nuance of the classroom.
Right.
And that's ultimately where we come back time and time again. Whenever you get into a debate about grading, it's ultimately the reason people get so frustrated is you're saying, if I say your grading is not correct or there's something about your grading that could be better, I'm telling you you're not effectively communicating, and people take that personally.
Right. No, I agree. And I think a grade on participation and like citizenship or however they're called, those kind of grades, it does measure social relations and executive function. It's like, can I do things on a timeline? But then it's not really measuring the depth of my understanding of this concept nobody else gets, but I'm so shut down by not being able to turn it in on time or for whatever reason being penalized for that, that I'm not going to share my ideas because those are probably wrong, you know? just like everything, you know? So I see that a lot, and it's heartbreaking when you have students actually be able to articulate how that makes them feel, you know, when they're undervalued, when they're just over-complianced, you know.
Yeah, it's interesting, you know, and you talked about a little bit about the classroom experience too, of, you know, just, I think we've all had those moments where we start on a lesson and then you like you said, you fall into autopilot and then you look up and you go, wait, what the heck was I teaching?
What was good? Yeah.
What happened? This is a blur. Especially if you're middle and high and you're doing the same thing 6 or 7 times a day, then it's
right.
Mindless by the end.
It is. Yeah. But, and those are the moments to be human and to say, look, this is a perfect example of me not even understanding what I was talking about myself. Can somebody please explain it to me? You know, and then give somebody that leadership opportunity.
Yeah. Well, and I think all of this, right, it comes back to a need for honest and thoughtful conversation. Like there's a part of a lot of this where in the classroom, I don't think a teacher is comfortable often admitting they don't know or they don't know a better way. And I think leaders are in the same boat. I think principals would be uncomfortable saying, I don't know another way besides a faculty meeting or an email. So yeah. Those are my two choices, right?
Right.
And it's one of those, you know, the principal, it's just called The Principal. It talks about being a lead learner. And that step number one is admitting I don't have all the answers. So I'm going to learn alongside you guys. So if you have an idea or a solution or something that might work, tell me.
Yeah.
You know,
guide on the side.
Put a team around you as a leader that knows things you don't know. That's if you have a bunch of leaders or other, you know, leadership team on your campus that knows what you know or doesn't know any more than you know, that's a problem. Like that they're not helping you then. They're just doing menial tasks.
Right.
Well, and it's the same thing in the classroom. Take advantage of what the kids know. They know things you don't know.
Yes.
It's not absolutely. The content knowledge. They know they don't know the content knowledge you do. That's fine. But they know things you don't know, so right. Use it.
And if every classroom had that as just an understanding that there are so many dimensions to intelligence, there are so many dimensions to skills and to leadership, can you be a leader in this moment? Can you be the expert in the room in this moment? And then I think it just makes the classroom a more fertile place for collaboration and for learning that is lower stakes and that, you know, especially from the teacher perspective. The worst thing is being considered the expert in the room and then saying something erroneous or just like totally, totally bizarre, or I don't know. And then it's really hard to backpedal from that when you're trying to fulfill this captain of the ship metaphor, and you just let the ship sink. Whereas like, if you are just somebody on this ship and say, hey, I need some help, you know, let's rally up. Who can do this? That's, I think, a much, much better model for students and teachers and admin. You know, that's absolutely. Yeah.
That's good. That was a nice little, that was a nice little combo woven in and out of that communication chain.
Wahoo.
Like good stuff. Awesome. All right, let's go to question two. Question number two is, what is something you're doing you wish all educators would do?
It's little, but it's big at the same time. So, and also connected to communication, I'm finding honoring student devices. And I think that means instead of vilifying the cell phone, vilifying whatever other piece of tech the student brings into the classroom, and trying to create rules and regulations and protocols around it, honor it, invite it, and teach them how to use it in a different way. And I think that it's just like a very basic way of meeting a student where they're at. Because a lot of their life is spent on that device. I have a 9-year-old daughter, and she is actually in the first generation of, I can't remember the name of the study, I'll have to look it up later, but there's a study that basically her generation is the first that has always had access to augmented reality and virtual reality. Where there's just this other place you can go, you can, it's something that is just embedded in everything they do in school, everything they do in many social circles, you know, so it's just there, it's been understood. I think as that generation goes to school, and you know, kids in school and in high school right now are very much in the same boat, that it's part of who they are. It's part of their identity. It's part of their modality. It's part of what their understanding of communication is. And it's a perfect opportunity for learning. And if we shut it off, shut it down, not only are you losing the opportunity to teach them a different way to use it, a more effective way, a more responsible way, But you're also kind of attacking their identity and their character. So is it important to have to set expectations and standards? Absolutely. I'm not saying it's like a free for all, but I am saying it's a consideration. And I think there are so many ways. I am a Nearpod nut. I use Nearpod in my classroom every day. And what I love about it is it brings the slideshow to a student device, to a device, you know, anywhere in the room. I just gave a presentation at Caltash this last weekend in Sacramento on using virtual reality for IEP coaching. I did the whole presentation on Nearpod, and this was a group of people ranging from very young children to people in their 70s and 80s. They all pull out their cell phone and they hop on the Nearpod and they can follow along on my presentation. They can engage with what I'm doing. There's polls, there's different virtual reality experiences, there's ways you can draw it, there's collaboration boards. It just makes it kind of what we were talking about before. It takes it away from me, like, you know, sage on the stage and more the guide on the side, like saying, hey, let's investigate this together. So I think, you know, that's one real and easy way to honor student devices is to use something like Nearpod, or there's a calculator called ClassCalc that is up and coming. that actually has this whole takeover mode. So it's kind of like a handshake agreement with a student, and you say, all right, student, we're taking a test right now. So we're in test mode, and we are, I'm going to have my little platform on my computer. I'll know that you're signed in. And then this program is actually blocking you from everything else on your phone so that you can use it as a calculator, and this robust scientific calculator that has a lot of really great visuals and stuff. So it's saying, you know, we're making an agreement that you can use this tool if you can abide by this agreement, you know, and then you can leave at any time, you can exit it, but then I know you're not on there, so please put your phone away. So I think it's little things like that. Well, I guess it's kind of a big thing, but just being able to have students at least collaborate in what the cellular device protocols are in the classroom. And I still see a lot that just the first thing when you walk in, just so all students see it, there's a picture of a cell phone with a note. You know, it's like, check that part of yourself at the door. You're not allowed in here, you know. So it's a different way of thinking, and it wasn't intuitive to me at all. And I was definitely, when I was subbing, for sure, I was in the camp of those go away right now. You know, your attention is mine. Your teacher wants me to tell you this. It's really important. It's the most critical thing on your day, you know? I think I just kind of, once I saw how big of a part of their lives it was, I wanted to teach them how to use it and how to manage it themselves, how to self-discipline, how to be balanced, how to be aware of their surroundings. And I think you can't do that with just compliance.
Yeah, you know, I like that you came back to it at the end. Is like, there is a part of this where adults struggle with balancing these things, right?
Right.
I mean, how many of us have gotten our spouses irritated at us because we were playing too much on our phones? We were supposed to be watching a show together or watching whatever. She was telling me how her day was, and I was playing on my phone, and she didn't think I was listening. And then not everybody can do what I do and then repeat back verbatim what she just said to me.
Right.
Which doesn't work well for her, but I mean, it doesn't help anybody else either. So yeah. My point is, we all need to be better at paying attention, right? Like, we all need to be better at learning these skills and learning these strategies. And so we did not grow up with these devices. And so we're having to learn through trial and error in the real world.
Right. Absolutely. But
these kids are growing up with their devices, which means they're going through school in a time where they could be taught this as a thing you learn in school.
Yeah.
Right. And I think that so often we try to create this, you know, it was a few weeks ago, one of my guests, we were talking about how all the arguments about the whole idea of once you get in the real world, well, the only thing that makes the classroom not the real world are the compliancy things we put in place in our classroom.
Right.
Everything else about our classroom is real. Just the things that we choose to enforce are the things that make it not the real world. So why are we still keeping this mindset around? And the cell phones are one that I have said for so long. Like, I would run PD and I'd have the teachers in the room sitting there playing on their phones and doing stuff on their phones. I never told anybody to put their phone away. Like, I'm an adult talking to adults. I'm not going to do that. But then when they would try to complain, like, oh, what about the cell phones? What are you going to do when they're on their cell phones? Miss McKimmy, blah, 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 blah. I go, before you asked me this question, not paying attention to me. Like, I'm sorry, but no. And I would call them out. And I'm like, listen, that's what you're doing. No one ever taught you, and it's not my place to teach you, but it is your place to teach kids something. And maybe you choose this is the thing you want to also include, because this is something that can go side by side with standards.
Absolutely. Like,
this isn't something that necessarily takes extra time. It's just something you do with it, right?
And there's so many pathways that the devices can take them if we allow them in the room. Yeah, totally. And it's one more way that we can create tiny traumas. By telling somebody to put away part of what they consider to be their identity, you know, and it's huge. I'd much rather teach them how to balance.
It is a tiny trauma if I forget my cell phone or if my phone dies.
Yes.
Ugh. It ruins the rest of my day.
It does.
It ruins the rest of my day. Because then what am I going to do all day? I what am I going to work? It's ridiculous. I mean,
come on.
Don't be silly. I was in New York City last weekend, and my wife and I, like, the first day, because of the flight and using our phones on the plane and then not wanting to sit in the hotel room and let them charge and just, like, get around New York City, by the end of the day, our phones were pretty much dead and we were on conservation mode, like airplane mode until while I used mine. And then it was, okay, well, one of us has to know how to get on which subway to get us back to our hotel. Right, so you had to, like, better not be dead. I don't know.
What analog. Oh, man.
So we kept hers alive long enough, thankfully. But at the same time, it was, you know, there were some moments there. I was like, ooh. And then, but then my phone was dead. Now I'm uncomfortable the whole time. I don't even know what time it is.
But you know, this is me thinking of that collaborative moment that you just allowed yourselves because you were collaborating on whose battery is going to last, you know, that.
Yeah, exactly. No, but I think if we're teaching some of those real world skills of, you know, there is a time and a place. And
right.
You know, I've said before, like, while I'm doing direct instruction, not that I even do direct instruction, but while I'm doing direct instruction is not the time to be on your cell phone. That is, that is not the time, unless I'm using a Nearpod or something where that's an engagement in it. But if I'm having a quick 10-minute intro lesson on something that's just verbal and I want them to catch so that they know it for the next activity, not the time to be on your cell phone. Put your phone away. Face down. Don't even be away. Just face down.
Yeah, it's not just face down.
Face down. Let's move on.
Yep.
And then, but once I release them to do the work, if they choose to check a text message real fast, that's okay because 9 teachers out of 10 I've seen, they release them to do their work, go check their phone or their computer for an email or whatever. So why are you telling kids they can't?
You know, the little thing there, it also becomes a comparison that I'm more important than you are, you know, because I've seen teachers actually say this, you know, a student calls them on checking their phone in class and they say, well, I'm a teacher. Like, what are you saying in that moment? Like,
I'm a hypocrite.
I'm a hypocrite.
If I'm going to do it, I'm going to own it. See, like, no, I know I'm an adult hypocrite.
I'm an adult hypocrite. I love that.
There's times where that is justified. Like there are times where the rules are not equal. Like, that's okay. But if you're going to do it, own it. Like, say, no, that's because I'm a hypocrite.
Exactly. But
and then they look at you like crazy every time. They're like, and I'm like, well, that's what you were asking, wasn't it?
Right. Yeah. Because we created this classroom contract together and I'm breaking it. So I'm a hypocrite. But that's really awesome. I love that response.
I mean, like I said, if I do something, I own it. I can't really say otherwise.
Yeah.
But my kids always, the one that happens all the time in our school, our media specialist has a rule about how you exit the media center because we have doors on either side and she wants one to be the entrance and one to be the exit. And if you go through the exit door, you're supposed to go all the way around the circulation disc, just like a flow of traffic thing. And it makes sense. We're a big school. I get it. But I'm an adult and I need to get to the courtyard to my duty station. So I'm going to go the wrong way every single time. And they call me out. They're like, Schreffler, you can't go that way. And I'm like, nah, I'm a hypocrite.
I'm a hypocrite.
Keep walking.
Story. So this year I was teaching on the variance. It's just reminding you of this. We had a similar thing at the high school I was teaching at, where apparently it was okay for faculty to cut the flow. So it was the lunch line. And if you had a faculty ID badge, you could cut to the front of the line. So I did one day. I usually just waited in line because I'm like, I'm just going to be compliant and I'm going to be a good model, blah, blah, blah. but then I was just running late and I had to get somewhere. So I cut in line and the lunch lady called me on it. And she's like, hey, you can't cut in line. I'm like, I'm faculty. I thought I could. She's like, no, you're not faculty. You've got to be like 15 or 16. I'm like, no. And then she's like, my grandson could beat you up. You are like 15. And I'm like, my grandson. No, I'm 25.
That's good. That's good. I've never been mistaken as a student. That's fun. I've never had that problem. But I like the cell phone thing. And I think it does speak to a bigger conversation of just, you know, I do get it. There are kids that are going to be a distraction. And I think, like you said, having a contract or having a rule system in place where repeated violations, you know, one of the things we talk about at our school all the time is we're going to address student behaviors.
Right.
So it comes up with cell phones and it comes up with dress code. I'm not going to address someone's dress code. I'm going to address student behavior. And so
if
students are distracted in class, I'm going to address the distraction.
Right.
And I'm not going, and I'm going to say, hey, this is a distraction. I need you to fix this. Or, hey, you can't wear that. I might say, I need you to fix this. Like, fine. I need you to fix it. But that's not a go home for the day. Like, that's not a whatever. It's a, hey, put that away. We're not using that right now. You know, put on a sweater, whatever it may be. Right.
Yeah. Let's fix this.
Let's just fix it. And let's keep learning because that's actually why we're all here. And let's try to keep remembering that. But then when the student pulls their phone out again 5 seconds later, now I have an insubordination issue, and that's a behavior I can address. It's not the cell phone. It's the fact that I asked them to do something and they didn't do
exactly.
it. It happens to be a cell phone, or it happens to be taking a sweater back off, or it happens to be ripping up paper and throwing it on the floor. It doesn't matter what it is. It's the behavior that we're going to address. And I think if teachers kept that mentality in mind more often, and I'm sure it's not teachers listening to this podcast anyway, so we're probably preaching to the choir.
Yeah, but probably.
If we keep that mentality in mind, I think that's just such a better way to look at addressing behavior, and not the way you learn in school or in textbooks, in my experience either.
Yeah, no, exactly. It takes practice, and it takes a lot of really good coaching sometimes. And that's honestly where I struggle in this, is how to handle that with seeing it in other, you know, dealt with other staff, because I don't want to undermine somebody. I want to undercut them. But if I see something handled in a way that's just like, hey, you know, compliance, what's the best way to address that? I'm still often come up stumped with that, because I always try to take the collaborative approach. I'm like, hey, you know, I saw how that student was behaving, and I saw what they did, and I just wonder, you know, what else could I have done? And that, you know, something like that, like asking I wonder questions or using I statements. But it's sometimes hard, because often what's on the line is somebody else's pride, and then it becomes a pride piece.
Well, I think that, you know, on some level, there are teachers that you are not going to move until there's a larger groundswell, right? I think that's why, even when I say preaching to the choir on this show, like, there are things I talk about on here repeatedly, and there are conversations that come up rarely. And, you know, even still, I think it's worth putting that out there, because the more people that join each movement, that sounded stupid repetitive, but once the motion starts, more and more people, you know, are going to get on board, and there is a peer pressure component, and there are some who you're not going to move until that has become way more mainstream. And so you got to kind of work with the ones that'll listen.
Right. And present evidence.
I like it. Rolling. We're 46 and a half minutes in. We are
great.
Two of three questions down. We got one left to go. All right. Question number three for Dan Roeder. Who is the best teacher you've ever had?
I actually already mentioned him.
When you mentioned him in the beginning, I was like, you might be burying the lead on this one.
But. Yeah. So I had listened to your podcast before, and I forgot what the third question is. So Robert Sieving. What I loved about him was just his patience, and his skill and his pedagogy were just all aligned. And the other piece is, everybody was slightly a tiny bit scared of him because he was so amazing. And I think that's hard to muster as a teacher. It's hard to really get to that point where you have all of these things in balance and aligned, where you're inspiring people, yet they're still kind of afraid of you a little bit, maybe not afraid, maybe that's the wrong word, but just in awe and not wanting to say the wrong thing or do the wrong thing, and always wanting to raise themselves to a higher standard. He definitely cultivated that in people. I had never been interested in music. I was not a kid who took piano lessons or voice lessons or like kinder music or anything like that. I expressed interest when I was in second grade to my parents that I wanted to learn the piano. And they said, no, your brother quit after a year, so you're going to do the same thing. That's not a thing. I'm like, okay. So I started teaching myself piano in high school, and I'm like, oh, I kind of dig this. And so he just had that way about him that was always wanted you to get to the next level. And one thing that I took from him that I'm still trying to figure out if I want to, you know, find a way to use it. I just love the philosophy behind it. He had what's called an A extension policy, and I haven't read a lot in all my teacher reading on it. But he basically, his philosophy was, you come to class, you show up, you participate, you know, you do everything I ask you to do. You have a B, but for the entire course of the semester, and of course you could lose points for like not coming to concerts, mm-hmm. whatever. There's concert attire, stuff like that. But if you really value being excellent and want to really live up to what this A is supposed to mean, then you need to do an A extension project. And you need to go research a piece of music and give a presentation about it. Or you need to write a song. Or you need to get a vocal group together and do a quartet. You need to, whatever. You can pitch your own project. So he was basically doing project-based learning the way that I understand it today in the early 90s. And it was just beautifully crafted. And everyone's like, okay, I know exactly where I stand. I know that if I want to be status quo, I'll get a B. B's are great. They're good stuff. Or if I want this A, I really need to raise the bar and extend myself and go out of my comfort zone. And I love that. And I think, you know, that's what really drew me to teaching, is getting kids to feel like that. You know, that they want to be better.
I like that. I like it. Man, I don't even have anything to add except that I love band directors.
Yay!
But other than that, yeah, that is cool. And I like the A extension. I've heard of things similar to that, but I don't think I've heard it done quite like that before. And that's really cool. That is a very powerful way to accomplish that goal.
Right. Right.
That's good.
Yeah, and it made me really think. I mean, I'm just thinking about it right now. Like, the rest of our grading systems are often like we're starting with this A, and we're just degrading it, you know, and saying, oh, we didn't do that as well as we could have. We didn't do that. Okay, well, now here we end up in this B range, and you know, we do all the work that we can, and we can feel really good about it, but. You know, since everything's just been degraded, we haven't really moved forward. But if you're starting at kind of this middle of the road, and you know, it's a gracious B, you can always say, hey, I want to be excellent. I want this to be what I earn. And I deserve to get an A in this. Because like all of the kids that were like I wasn't concerned about a 4.0, you have to do it. It's like it's written in your blood that you have to do the A extension project to do anything. But then in doing that project, you really are pushing yourself, and you're not just maintaining. I think it's just a really good out of the box way to reach those students who tend to be bored and who tend to. You know, you're kind of having them spin their wheels a little bit, saying, okay, can you help so-and-so? Cause you know, we're not there yet. Or can you, whatever it is, instead of giving them an extension project, we're having them become TAs. I don't jive too well with that. I'm like, if you want a TA, get a TA. But, I think it's that, making sure that we are providing variability and differentiating and making sure that we're doing that collaboratively with the student and, you know, attaching it to their interests. And I think it's really the best way to reach every student, because you can reach every student even if they need intervention, as long as you tie an intervention to their interest. And I think that's what that A extension project did for me. It made me take something I was interested in and go further with it.
I think that's just a great place to leave it.
Yeah, there we go.
That's a great place to close it out, man. Just, you know, the clear and honest communication. I think that's what this one's called. Just
yeah.
Dan Roeder, clear and honest communication. I think that's where we're at. So for my audience, if they have more questions for you, I'd like to reach out, connect. How can they find you?
I am on Twitter. It's DannyBrook734. And that's probably the best way. I'm on Instagram, but that's more of a family thing, and Facebook, but I'm actually not on there that much. I'm kind of like in the Twitter sphere now. It's my place.
Link, of course, in the show notes to that. You can check it out there. And Dan, I really appreciate your time, and this was really fun. It was a good chat.
Yeah.
I like it. And look forward to your podcast coming out soon.
Absolutely. So maybe we'll just call it Clear and Honest Communication.
Clear and Honest Communication. I like it. You got to fit an ed in there though. Yeah. You got to fit something to clear and honest
communicate. Clear ed honest communicate.
Cleared. Okay. There we go. That's almost worse. That's good.
I know. Yeah. But it's just cheeky enough.
Yeah. Just cheeky enough. All right. Well, Dan, I really appreciate it, man. Thank you.
All right. Thank you.
Dan, thanks for joining me on the show and having such a great chat. It was really a lot of fun. To connect with Dan, find him on Twitter at DannyBrook734. If you have comments or questions about the show, you can always connect with me on Twitter or Instagram at Brad Shreffler. I'd love to hear from you guys there, and that's also a great place to connect if you'd like to be a guest on the show. Or check out the feedback page on my website that gives you other options for feedback as well, which you can find at bradshreffler.com/feedback. Until next week, think about how you can make your communication clearer. Music for the Planning Period podcast is the song Vicious by Kevin MacLeod, used under Creative Commons. You can find him at incompetech.org. The Planning Period podcast is a proud member of the On Podcast Media Network. You can hear other great shows by hosts such as Mike Washburn, Glenn Irvin, Dan Krynas, and many more by visiting onpodcastmedia.com. The Planning Period podcast is also a member of the VoiceEd Radio Network. You can hear this show and tons more, including regular live interviews about education, at voiceed.ca. VoiceEd Radio, your voice is right here.